Fish number 10699.
Brigadier Rymer Jones, Reel 11. You were telling me about the sway in fortunes in 1918.
Yes, well, of course, Ludendorff's main idea was to attack in the north and finish the war. But I say in the north, north of where these punctures of our line were taking place. So that really this was only in order to attack in Flanders and finish the war. It didn't happen. Foch was given command of the combined forces of the Allies, and his whole idea was always attack, attack. Now that system nearly lost us the war at Verdun, when Pétain came in and said you cannot win the war by attrition and merely using our men as cannon fodder. And having rescued them then, he was behind the scenes in this part of the world because he was the greatest leader in the First World War, in spite of his tragic fall from grace in the Second. So that there we were with the bastion of Arras being one of the principal advantages that we held, because they never got through there. And when the actual, we weren't there, we'd passed on to other things. But when the great attack came there, the Germans were so confident. They hadn't got the weather and the fog and all the rest in their favour on this occasion. And they came over confident they were going to sweep it away and tackle our old haystacks on the for the guns. And I spoke to an officer who was there at the time. He said it was quite incredible how the Germans were coming over the ridge to their trench lines and over to ours. And they were so confident they were driving their vehicles in column, their batteries, as if they were on the march outside. The officers leading, mounted, wearing white gloves to celebrate the occasion. And they were swept away, thanks to Willis and Kerr. So gradually things settled themselves, and the Germans were becoming rather desperate in their attacks. And where we were was stabilized. It was quite quiet. And the first move to the days of triumph was when the French were being attacked in the south. And they followed under Pétain's suggestion, defense in depth, instead of shoving everything in the front line where it came, was cut to get pieces. In that stage, I remember on the Lys during those desperate days, my own division, the 40th, they were chopped up very badly, and my trench mortar men, the little man who'd been a Carter Patterson's boy with a comrade as his position, they barricaded themselves in the treasure and fought it out to the death. And this is seeing Britain at its best. These weren't the volunteers of the old days who took it as a privilege to be killed and so on. But these were the pressed men of the latter days. And they became heroes. It was men who were little thought of who became the terrors of the Germans. There was one division which they had at the top of their black list. And these were men that we didn't think were the tops, but they were British. The Gort, the brigade Gort was in, commanding the 1st Grenadiers, came back to us, and things were preparing for the great advance. Well, we did all the right things for a change. We'd fought a war over the years where we let them know we were coming. What's commonly known as telegraphy of punches. And in this case, we'd learnt to hide our attacks. And this was, funnily enough, everywhere that we changed our methods. And Allenby, in his great slaughter of the Turks, and finishing the war out there, he used the same things, disguising the attack, moving at night from one place to another so we weren't where we were expected, and then putting in your strong attack and going right through. Unfortunately, we still hadn't got much in the way of reserves in our attacks. And one of the chief things was that the cavalry, as gallant as anybody, they were the only reserves we had at one time at Cambrai. We hadn't got any reserves really except the cavalry, and they couldn't do anything. We still imagined that we could fight as in the Boer War or in the Crimea War, and it was pathetic, really. The horse was almost finished, although we clung to it until the next war. We had grey horses, and during this advance forward, we were coming over the crest. And the German machine guns were terribly good still. And we lost 80 horses of our graves. All those facts. So that in all the attacking after that, before we could be made up again, we were having to go forward one section, two guns, every day in turn, and then dragging up all the transport that night till next day when another one went forward and so on, which was a tremendous handicap, as you would agree.
What rank were you at this time?
Rank? I was captain.
And were you still doing the same job?
I was number two, but what with the COs being wounded and so on, I was as often as not commanding the battery. Well,
what did that entail? What were the extra responsibilities that you had?
My responsibility? Well, you were commanding a battery in action. And also going forward. And you made your junior officers more responsible for open fighting. Now, when we were going forward in this way, I had an officer posted to me. He had a most extraordinary history. He was a very nice chap. And he had been posted to the battery. We were in action, of course, earlier on. And he was wounded on the way up. All right, he was treated in hospital. He wasn't a very bad wound. And up he comes again in a month's time to join us. And he goes, of course, to the wagon lines to start with, and he's told to, by the captain, to go and water the horses, which was very important. We were so busy, it was hot, and it was very difficult to get water. So he's standing there watching the horses getting water, and a shell came over and blew him down the well. Well, he recovered again, and he joined us during this, when we'd really got going in the advance. And He came to me and he said, you know, I've learnt all sorts of things in the school, but I've never learnt anything about open fighting. I said, well, we've all got to learn, you know. He said, I feel I ought to be posted to something behind, to the DAC, Divisional Ammunition Column, or something like that, because I don't think I'm giving value. I said, my dear chap, you're not going to give way. After all, look at these chaps, look at our men. They're all having to get used to it. And you've got to think that if you're in command of a section, you must go forward and you must be somewhere up behind to see what they're doing, because they're going to come on surprise attacks. We lost some very good officers in that way, ran up against the machine guns. I said, you've got to use your head. You've got to send men forward to find out where the machine gunners are, and then work out some way of getting round or getting at them or shooting them. He became very good indeed. Excellent chap. It only required determination, you know. Well, off we went.
Sounds like the techniques of open warfare were a lot more demanding for the artillery.
Oh, not for the artillery, but for the officers. For the officers and men, certainly. Because you needed imagination, you see. You're on your own. Now, during this advance, for instance, the adjutant was away, and the colonel said, I want you as the adjutant while he's away. So I went there. Not my cup of tea, really.
This is adjutant of the brigade, the artillery brigade.
Adjutant of the brigade. And, however, I was able to hand over for a bit at one point to the orderly officer, I think they called him. It wasn't very tense at the battery then. At the brigade, at the batteries. And I went forward. I thought, I'll have a peep myself, what's going on. And I went forward to show how fluid it was. I came up to a post where there was a young officer, I don't think he was much good, and he'd been left there by his company. They said, you stay there. I said, what are you supposed to do? I don't know, I'm waiting for more orders, you see. Just then, a pipsqueak or whiz-bang came over nearby, and he looked at me and he said, that you duck? I said, well, it's not much good, because it was a whiz-bang. The bang comes before the whiz. So you're pointless. They're quite pointless in doing that. But I said, all right, are you the front line? Are you the front post of your battalion? He said, oh, I think so, I'm not sure. So I said, well, you hang on here and don't shoot me up, because I'm going forward to see if I can find what's happening. I went there and I came out where it was open country. And this was, to me, terribly important. There were our troops, the most frontal troops, and suddenly across from the other side, there was quite an open space, came running hundreds of Germans to give themselves up. Because they were losing morale, which was stabilized by those magnificent machine guns still. And to my horror, I saw the German guns and machine guns turned on their own people trying to give themselves up. I thought, well, this is the beginning of the end, obviously. Well, we went on, there was a stand on our part of the front on the River Sel. And in front of us, we were covering the part where there was the large village of Salem across the river. Now, at night, as a guard sergeant was taking several of his men swimming across the river and joining the French who were still in the village, living in the village, in the cellars, you see. And what was so typically French, it was very gallant of them still to be there, that they were selling coffee to the sergeants and his men as a Franco mug. And yet they say that the British are the nation of shopkeepers. Next morning, we were due to attack again there, and we were still putting, when there was any definite resistance, putting up a creeping barrage. And when you were doing these barrages, whoever was senior officer there was giving the lifts that had been worked up every 5 minutes or whatever it was, or 2 minutes if you like. And the battery officers, like myself and the other one, on this occasion, the captain had come back. I was only made a captain again after this. I was made a major for the last few days of the war. But on this occasion, I was a subaltern kneeling behind my two guns. The other chap had his two guns. And a pipsqueak came over. I should think it was 40 yards away, maybe 30. And the tiniest piece of metal. I didn't know whether it was small or what it was at the time, hit me on the left knee, which made such a difference to my life afterwards, and still does. But it knocked me flying. It was the tiniest thing. And I sort of had a look at it afterwards. I always had buckskin breeches, which I was very proud of. And it had penetrated that in the leather. And it knocked me over, but nothing very bad. So I rang up Donak, that's Division of Artillery, and spoke to the staff officer there. And he said, well, mind you go to the place to have it looked at, because you might suffer from that in after years. Meaning I could claim, you see, which I did on a stupid occasion. And so I went over there and had it dressed, and then went back to the battery. So they said, are you all right? I said, oh, yes, I can carry on. But I was due to go forward as the battery representative on horses to see where the next line of resistance was, with the retreating Germans. Well, I couldn't go, and a fellow called Joe Marks, a South African, went instead. He was very anxious to get back because there were certain reasons that he wasn't allowed to go on leave, and his family were getting a bit worried about why it was. So Joe goes forward with one of the majors and a representative from each battery on horses, and they come up against machine gun, and he's hit in the leg. Next thing I know, Joe is being carried over on stretchers across the river with a smile all over his face because he's got a blighty one, you see. That was some of the least, I think that was some of the most resistance we had until the end. And
during the period you were adjutant, what did that entail, being adjutant for Vickery?
Entail? It entailed keeping him wise as to what divisional artillery headquarters wanted in the way of action by us, and getting it going too. So the end really came. It wasn't so terribly exciting, even getting wounded, because there was no. It was too easy, really. In that way, we were getting resistance. We were getting casualties, some nasty ones. In fact, one of our sister batteries, the major, had a little bivvy the night before the 11th November, and under a tree. And just one shell came over and killed him. A few hours before, they rang up and they said, all right, go into Maubeuge Aerodrome and have your stables work on that. And we were quite honestly fed up. There was no feeling of exhilaration. I don't think it had been all along. It was just determination not to be done by the Hun. But there was no real feeling of triumph then. Of course, we were merely the little bits down below who were doing the fighting, you see. But at Temerin we went into stables on Maubeuge Aerodrome. While we were there, one of our squadron commanders landed on the thing and came over to speak to us. And he said, we said, what are you doing up here? And he said, well, I'm up to see that our chaps don't stop fighting too early, which was rather stupid, I thought. He said, would anybody like a lift? The major said, well, I can't leave. So I said, because I was with him too, I said, I'd like a lift. And he flew over where the war had started, where the Canadians were in Mons. And we were over there when 11 o'clock came, and the Canadians were still fighting for a long time afterwards, while we were having a good time. So that was the end of the war for us, while they were all getting drunk and stupid in London and places. I don't blame them in a way, but in no war was I in position to shout hooray when the armistice or the end of the war came. And meanwhile the Germans had retired 3 miles beyond Maubeuge, and we were on this side, so we're going into the aeroplane to stop there. The Germans came back actually to adjust the other side of Maubeuge, and we were able then, the guards, to parade, beat the retreat at night with the delighted citizens of Maubeuge all watching and so on. And we were there until another part of the story entirely was when we moved into Charleroi, which had been occupied, of course. And from there, after a very interesting time, we're given orders to march up to Cologne in snatches every day. Now, what was our feeling towards the Germans? Well, there we were in Charleroi, where I was billeting the troops, and I made the officers' mess and the officers' quarters. I went and saw the general manager of the mines, Charleroi, who had a little chateau. He said, oh yes, rather, we welcome you here. We can't feed you and so on, so we're not positioned to do so, but we'd be delighted if the officers would come and have coffee with us afterwards. And then they talked about the occupation, because it was quite clear in the streets and what was happening that the girls had, who had cooperated with the Germans were having all their hair shaved off their heads and were being treated as outcasts. Quite properly, really, because although they say that the German atrocities, so-called, were much of them nonsense, and a great many of them were, such as the fact that they were using British corpses to boil down into fat and all this sort of nonsense. But on the other hand, this general manager took me down to the river and pointed out where some of his friends had been lined up and shot into the water. You see, Belgians, you know, are the two. They're the Walloons, who are the French Belgians, and they're the Flemish. Now, in both wars, it was the same thing, but particularly in this war, where when the Germans occupied there, they took away the cattle and the property from the French Belgians and gave it to the Germans. And this had a funny reaction, really, later, because after we'd done all this marching up into Cologne, we were billeted in five villages about 5 miles outside Cologne. And very comfortable they were. Well, at that time there was a lot of stuff going on. People who'd been a very gallant Scots Guard officer who'd been captured by the Germans, and he was always trying to escape and was always being caught. And he was sort of propaganda for the army headquarters saying, you must not fraternize with the Germans. He said, being a British, it always happens. And I'd put the major into the best billet. And I was humbly where there was a little mess. I had a little bedroom outfit so that I could be on top of things. But the major, he went there and had a talk. There were two daughters. They weren't very lovely either. But they said how they'd all got poisoned in bottles when the brutal British came in and that they were going to take poison and so on. Instead of which, she came down halfway through the night and said she was prepared to cooperate with the major. And half, at least half the men were immediately snuggled up with the German ladies. I think it was rather bad, but only to be expected. You know, you can't keep the men away from it. And so...
How did the German men react to that? Was it the local population at large? What were they? How did they treat you?
Well, they were very cooperative there. You must remember, these are the Cologne people. They were the people who nearly, between the two wars, separated themselves from Germany, so to speak. And well, that was a very good feeling. Now, it varied. In the village where I was, the burgomaster, who wasn't in that village, was one of these thick-necked, good old Prussian Huns. But he had a very charming, sensible girl who spoke English, acting for him, Fräulein Bauer. And she used to come and present any problems there were to us. And we used to give her coffee and so on, just the same as we're doing here. And she's a very nice woman indeed. One day, there was a rule by the British, I cannot see why, that we had to pay for everything. I know what it was, because of course Germany were collapsing financially,